in the hearing. Mr. Page, if you care to step forward.
We'll have rather brief discussions. Having conferred with my colleagues, we have concluded that while the process that has unfolded is extremely unsatisfactory and unfair on other submitters, including but not limited to Mr. May, Ms. Baker Galloway's last point is the telling one, that they would be in a worse position in terms of prejudice without this evidence than with it. That said, mindful of that prejudice, Mr. Page, I'll give you the option. You could either file more evidence before next week, if you're able to do that. If your witnesses are able to respond verbally, Mr. Taylor is able to respond verbally, we'll accommodate that too. And if you feel at the end of next week's hearing that, and indeed this will also go to the other submitters such as UCES, I think we're hearing from Mr. Williams on Monday afternoon, in opposition. If you feel that not all that could be said has been said by reason of the shortage of time and inability to consider the, as you say, constantly moving target, then I'll give you leave to file submissions and or evidence within a week after the conclusion of the hearing, and we'll consider it on the papers.
Thank you. Can I seek a further indulgence from you? I remain uncertain whether Lindu Bay Trustee's submission is to be confined by the provisions that are now in the supplementary brief from Mr. Ferguson, or whether the entire submission is still at large. You'll appreciate the difficulty that my planning witness will have in responding if he doesn't know what the scope or what it is that he's responding to is.
That's a fair question, Ms. Baker Galloway. I interpreted your answer to the previous question as saying you are keeping all options open and effectively everything, and should this go further, you will have available to you everything between your original submission and the case that Mr. Ferguson is now supporting. Is that your position?
That's correct. We're not amending our submission. But my point is that the only evidence you have in front of you is evidence that supports the revised position. Now, as we all know, through caucusing and further evidence and so on, it may be that the panel requires jurisdiction from where our original submission sits to propose an alternative framework that gives a better effect to a particular point that you might find. So for that reason alone, the submission has not been formally amended. It sits where it sits. But that you only have evidence to support the position is currently tabled by Mr. Ferguson's supplementary.
I understand. Your position will be that that's extremely unsatisfactory, Mr. Page. But I think that there, Glendu Bay is within its rights to do that. Of course, the Environment Court, should it, this matter end there, might take a dim view of having retreated in this forum and then attempt to retrieve the position in some other respect, but that will be a matter for another time, another place, and another determining.
Can I, before Mr. Page leaves, I've just got one further question of clarification. Given that Mr. May did not file any rebuttal evidence to our evidence in chief, is the leave being granted to Mr. May solely related to the position that is now contained in Mr. Ferguson's evidence, as it differs from the evidence in chief only, because otherwise it's leave that's been granted that should have otherwise, you know, addressed matters that should have been put in the rebuttal evidence by Mr. Page.
Remember the one about people in glass houses?
Want to be clear, so we're all clear.
In exactly the same way that I have reasoned from the fact that had you not put your supplementary evidence in, I would have asked your witnesses. I would have asked Mr. May and his witness what he thought of the shift in ground, and on that basis, the leave is general. And so I will formalise that decision, but you can take it as a given and say, Mr. Page, that if you are going to file for further evidence, it would be nice if we had it sooner rather than later. But at a certain point, it would always be useful to have your witnesses' further thoughts on paper, accepting that if time is short, they will have the ability to shift, shall we say, as we discuss it further, and as we're planning to break the hearing end of the 14th, that your leave to file written submissions and evidence will be 5 p.m. 7 days thereafter.
Thank you. Knowing what I've got on my plate between now and next week, and I suspect what Mr. Taylor has on his plate between now and next week, the prospects of having a further brief from Mr. Taylor fully prior to being heard next week are slim indeed, but I will discuss that with him when he arrives this afternoon.
And so as I say, if we end up having an iterative discussion verbally, then we'll accommodate that, and all else failing, while I've said we're going to close the hearing on the 14th, we do have the capacity to come back on the morning of the 15th if that is required.
Yes.
Thank you. I'll just write down some notes. So when I issue a written decision, it actually reflects what I've just told you. Galloway.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Consideration.
Now, it would pay if you didn't have handy Mr. Ferguson's supplementary, just in case we particularly want to need to refer to his appendices as we go through my opening submissions.
Another obvious comment, having received your legal submissions late yesterday afternoon, well, I have read them in detail. My colleagues have not. Commissioner McLeod is telling me feeling about reading your submissions at 2 a.m. this morning. So I think, while I don't want you to read the quotations you provided from the cases, I think you need to take us through these submissions
in more rather than less depth.
Very good, yeah. Thank you. So I've got some spare copies here. Should I have them?
You all have copies.
No.
I'd just like to also point out that that is how interesting my life is.
Me too. Right, so I'll start paragraph one. So these are part two legal submissions presented on behalf of the submitter, Glen Dubay Trustee Limited, in respect of parents, room 12, Alpha Cliff and Mecca. And they are supplemented by the part one legal submissions that I presented last week, just to introduce Dr. Roper Lindsay and Mr. McRae. Part two of these legal submissions will address the following matters: legal issues in relation to the introduction and context for the proposed Glendhu Station zone, the aspects of the zone proposal agreed between council and the submitter, and I can just emphasise that's based simply on looking at council's rebuttal evidence, not any sort of corpusing. The relevance of part two of the RMA in the district plan process, the relevance of the existing environment, very briefly, the relevance of environmental compensation and an overview of the Environment Court decision, an explanation of the future intended development under the zone and overlap of the covenant areas and the zone activity areas, and alternative options for refining the extent of the zone over rural land to respond to points made by Mr. Barr and Dr. Reid in particular. And then I touch on some key issues that are relevant to each of the activity areas that I've listed there. Introduction and context. The purpose of the zone, through the district plan review, is to create a framework that will manage, or better manage, an area of high quality landscape in a way that protects and enhances natural character, biodiversity and recreation values, and that enables an economically sustainable use of the land with activities that are complementary to that protection and enhancement. Lessons learnt on the practicality of implementing the consent, and that should read 5 years on from the final court decision, inform the development of a zone that will provide incentive for wider enhancement of natural character and biodiversity values than the consent and the rural zone combined. The proposed zone is intended to provide for a similar level and type of development as provided for through the Environment Court's Parkins Bay consents, with additions of a campground and farm homestead activity area and 8 further dwellings in the residential activity area. It's intended to be more flexible and easier to implement than the consent, but also to secure the same or better environmental protection and enhancements as the consent, and to enable medium to long-term planning and future development to occur on an integrated and comprehensive basis. The submitter is not seeking to strictly codify the existing consents, which stand on their own. Rather, the zone proposal should be viewed as an alternative means of providing for 42 home sites with the building platforms and design controls in the same area of the consented areas, rather than the precise dwelling designs in those areas as consented. 8 additional home sites, again with the 1,000 square metre building platform and design controls, in areas where the landscape can absorb that change. An extensive revegetation strategy, securing at least the same outcome as the consent and the potential for its extension. Non-compliant status for buildings that are in excess of the scale of development contemplated in the consent as set out in the covenants.
Liz Blake Galloway, is that right? I thought they were discretionary.
No, on areas that are subject to the consent notice and the covenant, buildings, except for the 2 dwellings that are also specifically contemplated in the consent notice, are non-compliant. That's the intention.
But Mr. Ferguson's evidence, supplementary evidence, is that you've got to change the covenants. So is that really where?
Ferguson's evidence is not that.
Well, let's go back a step. I read that this part of your submission is, and I was distinctly puzzled. Is the way that it will work, cutting to the chase, that if you get the zone, you will surrender part of the existing consent as you replace it with new consents under the new zone or with whatever activities are permitted.
There's no determined path, because it obviously will depend on what the zone looks like. One, and a surrender option doesn't seem like it's practicable, because works are already, you know, partly undertaken, and surrender would render those works unauthorised. So the most sensible option seems to be to either apply for variations to the main consent, but those variations would be considered under the zone framework, or to apply for additional consents and then determine the relationship between the new consent and the existing consent.
But under a subject more, the later consent would replace the earlier one to the extent that they overlap.
Potentially, but these are very hypothetical questions. So,
I'm not sure they are, because
hypothetical in that we haven't mapped out a path. We're trying to set up the zone and get the zone right, rather than having a predetermined consenting path after that.
Because, as you say, you haven't codified the consents, so there are areas where the zone provisions are less restrictive than the consent conditions, deliberately so. It seems to me that the utility of the zone depends on, in that, at least as regards those areas where the zone provisions are less restrictive, the entire utility of the zone depends on the conditions falling away, because if they don't fall away, then there's no point having the zone.
That's right. But as I say, that can either be through a variation to the existing consent, or through additional consents, and it really depends on whether you're talking about the campground activity area or one of the new 8 dwellings. And hypothetically, this is all, like I say, it is hypothetical for us, because we don't know the final shape of the zone, so we don't know the best consenting path. As you would have noticed, there's no permitted activities that all of a sudden enable and codify exactly what the consent authorises, so we don't have that framework. It's still a consenting path to add or amend activities and development in this area.
And going to where I started, last week I asked you the question whether there was a mismatch between the covenants and the new activity areas.
Mm.
And I think the thrust of Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence is yes, there is. And to the extent there is, you'll apply to change the covenants.
If an activity was authorised to be undertaken there. So there's only two areas of mismatch. It's the lakeshore, the boundary of the lakeshore activity area, and the extension of the Gulf activity area. In all other respects, the rules and the land provisions are meant to reflect the same protections that are registered on titles and the consent notice in government.
Well, as I read Mr. Ferguson's evidence, there's also a mismatch in the farm homestead area to the extent that it's on the western side of Motutapu Road. And in fact, there's a chunk of it to the east that's also outside the covenant area. But I don't think it matters.
No.
Because what I discerned from Mr. Ferguson's evidence, to the extent they're different, you'll apply to change them.
If an activity was if a consent was applied for, say, let's take the farm homestead. It's a restricted discretionary. It's supposed to be a restricted discretionary to do some of those the commercial activities that are defined in the definition of farm homestead area, so the abattoir, wedding venue. So you still need a consent to authorise those activities. the undertaking of those activities without additional built development is not contrary to the terms of the covenant. But additional built development, I think, would be for 20 years. So that's it. So on that site, no further development for 20 years after implementation of stage three. So if your commercial activity that is authorised as a restricted discretionary consent requires a new building that is development, then yes, it would not be able to be implemented until a change to the consent notice and the consent notice and covenant was obtained.
And, well, since I've started down this track, I'll swing with it. What is the legal process for changing covenants? I know there is one, but I've never had to look into it myself.
The covenant itself, I won't go into the legal process for changing it, but it's between covenants between, or at least when it was registered, and I think we handed up that covenant in companion with the legal submissions. The dominant tenement is the yellow land, to keep it really simple. Servient is the other colours of this covenant that relates to farm homestead, that's the hypothetical. There's also the clause in there that you might have talked about this concept with Mr. Goldsmith. Clause 2.8 of the covenant states that the grantor and grantee covenant that they will not vary or surrender the terms of the covenant without written consent of the council, such consent not being unreasonably withheld. So those, the three parties, the grantor, grantee and the council, between them have to agree to vary or surrender the terms of the covenant.
So the first two parties are both Glen Dubay parties, obviously.
Yeah, there. On the instrument I have, they're both Glen Dubay Holdings. Glen Dubay Holdings Limited. But like I say, the dominant tenement is lots 2, 9, 10 and 11, which is basically the yellow area. And the servient tenement are the other colours.
And on the basis, and if the consents still survive, then you need to vary them too.
The consent notice?
No, the...
and the consent itself.
The resource consent, which requires the covenants.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
The last question. You're in. Two dwellings in covenant area CH of lot 6 and CI, it might be L, of lot 7. Where are they on the map?
They are the green, the dark green. So the far, the right, lower right corner.
So on the frontage of the area F on the original plan.
Which plan are you looking at?
So many to choose from.
So Mr. Ferguson's supplementary is
that's the one I'm looking at.
Yeah. So it's if you look on the key, part lots 6 and 7, our covenant areas CH and CI.
So
that's intended to be entirely consistent with the resource consent and covenant, that provision.
Well, with that long digression, at my instigation, please carry on.
Thank you. And if opportunity to apply for limited activities within the farm homestead area and establishment of a campground in the sea area is also a restricted discretionary activities. Part one of my legal submissions did already address some significant background and context to the Parkins Bay development and the Glenview Station Zone proposal now before the Commission. Those submissions are not intended to be repeated here, however, I will refer to some critical extracts which are important scene setting for discussions today. The original Parkins Bay proposal, prepared by Derby Partners and the McRae family as owners of Glenview Station, was a joint vision to create a diversified and sustainable use of the unique Glenview Station land. As covered in the evidence of Mr. McRae, the Glenview Station land has been managed according to traditional high country farming practices for generations. However, in more recent time, this evolved into initiatives to farm in a more environmentally sustainable manner in alternative and complementary land uses such as ecotourism, weddings, recreation, tourism and residential activity complement the move away from traditional farming. The foundation of Parkins Bay was and still is a large-scale holistic management regime over the Glenview Station land. The case before the Environment Court was clearly not just a landscape case, although it was an important factor in a proposal to align with the protective operative Chapter 4 and 5 provisions. The proposal is of regional tourism and recreational significance and provides a comprehensive framework for increasing the Indigenous biodiversity of Glenview Station. Core findings from the Environment Court's interim and final decisions on the Parkins Bay proposal related to the overall positive benefits being presented by the developer and those contributing to achieving sustainable management on balance. Those considerations are now of equal importance in this district plan review process. Importantly, the submitter has ensured that the specific references in the zone purpose to ensuring a wide range of recreational opportunities and Indigenous vegetation benefits, which underlines the importance to the district of recreational and tourism activities and its natural conservation values. In all other respects, the intent of the zone is to replicate and build on the covenanted environmental benefits achieved through the Parkins Bay proposal into a zoning framework, so that those benefits continue to be secured in a transparent way. The proposal to zone the wider area as a special zone is consistent with the existing district plan framework, which includes other special zones and associated development opportunities, including, for example, ski area subzones that are not underpinned by an overall set of consented entitlements. Aspects of the zone supported by Council's witnesses. Those aspects of the zone's refined relief submitted in evidence in chief, which are supported by Council, are important to note at the outset. Those aspects are primarily included in Dr. Reid's evidence in paragraph 3.2 and include the fact that the submitter has removed the proposed lodge activity area from the evidence. There is a refinement of the lake shore activity area to the lower terraces. There's a removal of the fifth residential pod, originally located on the northern side of the Wanaka Mount Aspiring Road, and aggregation of four residential pods into one. And the infrastructure experts are in agreement that adequate infrastructure can be made available to service the zone.
Before you go on, can I just take you back to your 6D?
6D, yes.
And it occurred to me as you were reading that, is there any reason why, like the ski area subzones, this couldn't be a subzone of the rural zone?
A subzone? Probably a good question to ask Mr. Ferguson.
Yes, that's why I thought I'd ask you.
Yep.
So he's got time to think about the
answer. Good. Yes, and I might need to think about that too. And you probably would have, probably better that I get you a coherent answer. I could think of
always
the
better if you get a coherent answer.
Because, what approach is more simple, I guess, and easy to implement from Council's point of view would be one thing I'd like to tune my mind to.
The issue that prompts that question is that there is an issue going in slow circles in the Stream 1 hearing panel's collective mind about whether O&Ls and O&S are restricted to the rural zone.
Right.
So, depending on where that recommendation lands, it may be that the consequence of a special zone is that it would, in formal terms, take the zone out of the R&L. Take the land out of the R&L.
If that's where Herring Stream 1 goes.
If that's where Herring Stream 1 goes. Ergo, you would appreciate that would in fact create an issue for this panel about whether it felt comfortable accepting the relief that your client is seeking, if that was the end group, if that was one side effect, like a side wind. Whereas if it was a subzone of the rural zone, then we could put that to one side.
As
a non-issue.
Yeah.
So.
Because you would have noticed, we're not contesting the open
hour. Exactly. But yeah. This is more an issue about how your proposed zone fits into the plan as a whole, rather than the open. Like, it may not be disastrous, because at that point it would still be an O&L with non-capitalised, small O, small N.
That's right, so it's still a Section 6B matter. Yeah.
And that might be a, dare I say it, a flaw of the plan that would legitimise resort back to Section 6B in King Salmon terms, but it'd be an awful lot simpler.
Yes, okay.
So as I say, Keith, that's something for you to ponder.
Right, we'll ponder that and get back to you. Paragraph 8. So the above specific examples listed support the general sentiments expressed by Dr. Reid that in the main, the zone as amended would give rise to development which is closely in keeping with that consented, and Mr. Baer's support in principle for the reasons and vision behind the zone proposal. It is particularly relevant that those comments were made following the lodgement of evidence in chief by the submitter. Since that time, further refinements have been made to the zone provisions and structure plan, addressing each of Mr. Baer's helpful comments on the draft zone and further responding to matters raised by council witnesses. The submitter considers that the best outcomes for the PDP come when many eyes have input and the comments of the council's experts have therefore been appreciated, and the submitter is open to further refinement that might be arrived at by way of post-hearing caucusing between the planning experts at least. Now, changing topics a little, I turn on to the relevance of positive environmental effects in the district plan process. The Environment Court's interim and final decisions in Parkins Bay approved of the package securing environmental benefits offered by the applicant is ultimately weighing on the scales to bring the overall proposal in line with sustainable management. In particular, the court placed material weight on the fact the benefits are logically connected to the development, along with the scale of the benefits, such as fencing and removal of stock, ultimately offered as part of the whole package. I'll leave you to read those quotes yourself. The relevance of positive effects in the nature of environmental compensation have relevance as effects, so positive effects are effects. And this, once you get into that concept of environmental compensation, this has been sort of confirmed in a long line of cases pre-King Salmon. And those cases were primarily in respect of Section 104 considerations, so consenting cases, looking at effects on the environment. And when interpreting that phrase, effects on the environment, interpreting it as subject to Part 2 of the Act, which brings into play positive effects, as they are relevant to Part 2 matters. And in particular, as it's relevant to our, I'm sorry, I'm adding to my submission, I'm not trying to shorten them, as it's relevant to our proposal and the emphasis on conservation and enhancement of biodiversity values and recreation values and so on, the particular provisions in Part 2, where it's directly relevant to Section 7C, the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values, and section 7F, the maintenance and enhancement of the quality of the environment. So as long as part two is in play, which I submit it is, those particular provisions, it's consistent with having particular regard to those to place weight on the ability to enhance those aspects and amenity values and quality of the environment, which is very broad.
Tell me, I discussed with you last week the implications of King Salmon. We were reminding the conversation, we're still proposing to revert to me on that next week.
I'm not sure if there's much more detail I can go into.
All right, let me explain exactly my concern.
Okay.
I am thinking about the discussion of the Supreme Court that said that in relation to outstanding landscapes, that it was a standalone obligation that had to be recognised and provided for as part of Section 5 and was not susceptible to being balanced against other Part 2 considerations.
Right.
Now, you've answered the question about Davidson and Thumbpoint, and I want to come and I'll talk to you further about that a little later. But that's the point which I don't think you've answered.
So, is your question broader than what the NZCPS requires then?
Yes.
Okay.
Because as I read King Salmon, it said that, well, put another way, there are cases, and I think about the Genesis wind farm in the Manukau Heads, where the Environment Court decided that notwithstanding that it was an outstanding natural landscape, because there were other Part 2 issues at play, it could balance them within the overall balance of Section 5. That, which is another way of reasoning the discussion about environmental compensation. And it's in effect the argument you're putting to me. So my question, is that still good law post-King Salmon, given what the Supreme Court had to say about how Section 5 interrelates with the Section 6 powers?
Okay. I will take the opportunity to give you further submission. So the time frame for that, just so I don't...
5 p.m. on the 14th.
Okay. So your question is that in the absence of any national policy statement or RPS,
yes,
how does that affect your decision-making framework?
Correct. And while it was obviously overdue because there was a national policy statement in King Salmon, us mere mortals in this hallowed hall,
yes,
have to take some notice of overdue statements from the Supreme Court.
Yes. And so it's all about that concept of bottom lines, isn't it? Does
yes.
Section 6
yes.
set up bottom lines or not?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Okay.
All right. Very good. Right, so yes, I probably will supplement. I'll read through what I've written here anyway, but it will be supplemented and updated by the 14th. So as I noted last week, we've not found any other case which expressly take into account conservation gains and recreation benefits similar to the submitter's proposal in a plan change setting other than the Infinity Group, already cited, which stated in Novita that this approach was acceptable.
The question is that putting it too strong? I would have said implied.
I think it was that specific paragraph that I cited last week. that.
So you've maintained that
there was definitely opposite though.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Can I just confirm in the original evidence last week that was the paragraph 12, is it? The original evidence that you were talking about. Enjoying the discussion, not sure if I'm 100% following it. So just
No.
On the compensation amended by this decision is out.
No, it wasn't that one. It was next page 19, paragraph 19.
Above border a variation of plan change pushes. Thank you.
Roll on.
It is submitted, however, that there is no question that positive effects that not only protect but also enhance natural character, landscape, biodiversity and recreational values are relevant to take into account for the following reasons. I set out in Appendix 1 submissions that I will expand upon next week. In respect of Section 5's application for the hearing, and as such enhancement in the community wellbeing aspects of Section 5 are relevant. I flagged Council's Section 31 role includes the establishment, implementation and review of objectives, policies and methods to achieve integrated management of the effects of the use, development or protection of land, emphasising protection and associated natural and physical resources of the district. And this is a broad role which also includes the broad term effects under the Act, which according to Section 3 include positive effects. And then I haven't flagged there, but also just note, of course, Section 74 requires that preparation and change of the plan be in accordance with Part 2, so we're always still referring back to Part 2. And at C, the protective and enhancement aspects of the proposal are consistent with and give effect to the strategic objectives of the district plan as promoted by Council in its right of reply, and overall ensure the proposed zone is the most appropriate planning framework to give effect to those strategic objectives as well as the wider purpose of the Act. Now, obviously, those objectives are not settled. They are part of the moving goalposts. They may change, and because they may change again, that increases the reason to look to Part 2 also. But I've set out on the next page those key provisions as they relate, you know, as taken from Council's right of reply from that higher order chapters. And then finally, at paragraph 13, I refer you to Appendix 6 of Mr. Ferguson's evidence in chief, where he extracted the relevant provisions, in his opinion, from the operative and proposed RPS, and I've just listed the ones there that, on a reading of them, emphasise not just protection but also enhancement. So, not just at the Part 2 level is there that is it relevant that there is enhancement of those natural values, but also, even though they're not settled, at the strategic level in the district plan, the old operative RPS and the proposed RPS that's subject to some points of appeal, so again not settled, but there's still that theme there that you can take, you can put some weight on, as well as looking at Part 2. Touching briefly on the relevance of the existing environment, submitted that in considering whether the zone is the most appropriate zone to achieve the higher order objectives of the district plan in Part 2 of the Act, the decision of effects on the environment is the environment so modified by the Environment Court's consents already granted. Council's opening legal submissions accept that effects associated with Parkins Bay consent form part of the existing environment, and the Council's concerns, as I interpret them, are therefore limited to the following: that the activities proposed go well beyond that consented, as does the geographic area of the proposed zone, and whether the existing and complex consent conditions have been fully reflected in the proposed zone.
Probably something that you would take it as a given, but I don't think you should assume that because the council is comfortable that your proposal is within the existing environment that we are comfortable with, that that is the correct position.
Okay. Should I explore that a little?
and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
And then you can tell me your answer
right.
to my concern.
Yes.
The foundation of the existing environment where you have, where and to the extent that you have unimplemented consents, so that the changes to the environment are not sitting and looking at you, is of course the Hawthorne test, which Justice Fogarty here has told us not to read as if it were a statutory test, but because it's convenient, we'll do that anyway, and say whether it is likely to be exercised. My question is, given that the whole purpose of this zone is to provide a framework in which you can do something other than what the consents provide for, how can you say that the consents as they currently exist are likely to be exercised?
So one point before I answer your actual question, the zone is intended to not provide for something other than what is consented. It's intended to provide for what is consented and some additional methods. So the in terms of what is consented now, the golf course, the clubhouse, the 42 house sites, that is, you know, that, and as you've seen, that consent is in the process of being implemented. There's been over 20,000 plants planted and earthworks are being undertaken and all of those initial setup works and all of that investment is underway right now. So the evidence before you in terms of whether this consent is likely to be implemented is indisputable. And you will hear from Mr. Darby in particular, but Mr. Thompson, who's in the middle of designing the golf course, there is ample evidence for you to find that this consent in its current form is likely to be implemented.
Well, can we test that? Right. The consent has a golf course layout. Manifestly, Mr. Darby and Mr. Thompson are working on a different layout.
On a better layout.
Well, a different layout.
Yes.
No doubt the objective is that it's a better layout, but it's definitely a different layout. So it is not what the conditions provide for. And in fact, you've actually said you're not aiming to codify the conditions. You're providing a framework to do something different. Extended in some respects, the same in some respects, different in other respects. And so hence my fundamental question is, to the extent that it's different, how can you say that you're likely to implement it? The whole purpose of this exercise is to provide you with the ability to do something different.
That's right. But if for some reason that this process is unsuccessful, the fallback position is the consent that the implementation of which is in train, it is happening. So I think we're going around in circles now. This is an alternative method to achieve very similar outcomes on that site, from my client's point of view, better outcomes. But if this, for some reason, if this process is unsuccessful, implementation of consent is continuing. It's happening now. It's not as though nothing has taken place out there, as you saw yourselves.
Well, I completely understand. You're underway. You've done subdivision. There are diggers on the site preparing house sites. You have. So there are a range of things that are already happening. But I suppose I come back to the fact that you're seeking something different, and Mr. Darby pushes down the route in trying to make the case for something different about the question I was going to ask him. Is the counterpoint to what you've just said? If it doesn't get the zone, will he implement the consent as framed?
Well, as you probably picked up from Mr. Ferguson's evidence, and I can't put words into Mr. Darby's mouth, but is there have been a couple of variations to date, as the fine-grained analysis of what's on the ground has taken place. There are refinements and improvements that have been undertaken and put in place by way of variations. But yes, by all means, that's a question you can answer in terms of how it relates to what is the existing environment.
I wonder if we should stop there and have a cup of tea.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, since I've interrupted you yet again, we'll restart at 25 to 12.
Thank you.